5. Far from the main street, in one of the Negro sections of the town, Dr. Benedict Matty Copeland sat in his dark kitchen alone. It was past 9 o'clock, and the Sunday bells were silent now. Although the night was very hot, there was a small fire in the round-bellied wood stove. Dr. Copeland sat close to it, leaning forward in a straight-backed kitchen chair with his head cupped in his long, slender hands. The red glow from the chinks of the stove shone on his face. In this light, his heavy lips looked almost purple against his black skin, and his gray hair, tight against his skull, like a cap of lamb's wool, took on a bluish color also. He sat motionless in this position for a long time. Even his eyes, which stared from behind the silver rims of his spectacles, did not change their fixed, somber gaze. Then he cleared his throat harshly and picked up a book from the floor beside his chair. All around him, the room was very dark, and he had to hold the book close to the stove to make out the print. Tonight, he read Spinoza. He did not wholly understand the intricate play of ideas and the complex phrases, but as he read, he sensed a strong, true purpose behind the words, and he felt that he almost understood. Often at night, the sharp jangle of the doorbell would rouse him from his silence, and in the front room he would find a patient with a broken bone or a razor wound. But this evening he was not disturbed, and after the solitary hours spent sitting in the dark kitchen, it happened that he began swaying slowly from side to side, and from his throat there came a sound like a kind of singing moan. He was making this sound when Portia came. Dr. Copeland knew of her arrival in advance. From the street outside, he caught the sound of a harmonica playing a blues song, and he knew that the music was played by William, his son. Without turning on the light, he went through the hall and opened the front door. He did not step out on the porch, but stood in the dark behind the screen. The moonlight was bright, and the shadows of Portia and William and Highboy lay black and solid on the dusty street. The houses in the neighborhood had a miserable look. Dr. Copeland's house was different from any other building nearby. It was built solidly of brick and stucco. Around the small front yard, there was a picket fence. Portia said goodbye to her husband and brother at the gate and knocked on the screen door. "How come you sit here in the dark like this?" They went together through the dark hall back to the kitchen. "You have's grand electric lights. It don't seem natural why you all the time sit in the dark like this." Dr. Copeland twisted the bulb suspended over the table, and the room was suddenly very bright. "The dark suits me," he said. The room was clean and bare. On one side of the kitchen table there were books and an inkstand. On the other side, a fork, spoon, and plate. Dr. Copeland held himself bolt upright with his long legs crossed, and at first Portia sat stiffly too. The father and daughter had a strong resemblance to each other. Both of them had the same broad, flat noses, the same mouths and foreheads. But Portia's skin was very light when compared to her father's. "It sure is roasting in here," she said. "Seems to me you would let this here fire die down, except when you're cooking."
"If you prefer, we can go up to my office," Dr. Copeland said.
"I'll be all right, I guess. I don't prefer." Dr. Copeland adjusted his silver-rimmed glasses and then folded his hands in his lap.
"How have you been since we were last together? You and your husband and your brother?"
Portia relaxed and slipped her feet out of her pumps.
"Our boy and Willie and me gets along just fine."
"William still boards with you?"
"Sure he do," Portia said. "You see, us have's our own way of living and our own plan. Our boy, he pay the rent. I buys all the food out of my money. And Willie, he tends to all our church dues, insurance, lodge dues, and Saturday night. Us three have's our own plan, and each one of us does our parts."
Dr. Copeland sat with his head bowed, pulling at his long fingers until he cracked all of his joints. The clean cuffs of his sleeves hung down past his wrists, Below them, his thin hands seemed lighter in color than the rest of his body, and the palms were soft yellow. His hands had always an immaculate, shrunken look, as though they had been scrubbed with a brush and soaked for a long time in a pan of water.
"Here, I almost forgot what I brought," Portia said. "Have you had your supper yet?"
Dr. Copeland always spoke so carefully that each syllable seemed to be filtered through his sullen, heavy lips.
"No, I have not eaten."
Portia opened a paper sack she had placed on the kitchen table.
"I done brought a nice mess of collard greens, and I thought maybe we have supper together. I done brought a piece of side meat, too. These here greens need to be seasoned with that. You don't care if the collards is just cooked in meat, do you?"
"It does not matter."
"You still don't eat near meat?"
"No. For purely private reasons, I am a vegetarian. But it does not matter if you wish to cook the collards with a piece of meat."
Without putting on her shoes, Portia stood at the table and carefully began to pick over the greens.
"This here floor sure do feel good to my feets. You mind if I just walk around like this without putting back on them tight, hurting pumps?"
"No," said Dr. Copeland. "That will be all right."
"Then us will have these nice collards and some hoe cake and coffee. And I'm going to cut me off a few slices of this here white meat and fry it for myself."
Dr. Copeland followed Portia with his eyes. She moved slowly around the room in her stockinged feet, taking down the scrubbed pans from the wall, building up the fire, washing the grit from the collards. He opened his mouth to speak once, and then composed his lips again.
"So you and your husband and your brother have your own cooperative plan," he said finally.
"That's right."
Dr. Copeland jerked at his fingers and tried to pop the joints again.
"Do you intend to plan for children?"
Portia did not look at her father. Angrily, she sloshed the water from the pan of collards.
"There be some things," she said, "that seem to me to depend entirely upon God."
They did not say anything else. Portia left the supper to cook on the stove and sat silently with her long hands dropping down limp between her knees. Dr. Copeland's head rested on his chest as though he slept. But he was not sleeping. Now and then a nervous tremor would pass over his face. Then he would breathe deeply and compose his face again. Smells of the supper began to fill the stifling room. In the quietness, the clock on top of the cupboard sounded very loud, and because of what they had just said to each other, the monotonous ticking was like the word "children, children," said over and over. He was always meeting one of them, crawling naked on a floor, or engaged in a game of marbles, or even on a dark street with his arms around a girl. Benedict Copeland, the boys were all called. But for the girls, there were such names as Benny May, or Maddie Ben, or Benedine Maddine. He had counted one day, and there were more than a dozen named for him. But all his life, he had told and explained and exhorted. "You cannot do this," he would say. "There are all reasons why this sixth or fifth or ninth child cannot be," he would tell them. "It's not more children we need, but more chances for the ones already on the earth." Eugenic parenthood for the Negro race was what he would exhort them to. He would tell them in simple words, always the same way, and with the years it came to be a sort of angry poem which he had always known by heart. He studied and knew the development of any new theory, and from his own pocket he would distribute the devices to his patients himself. He was by far the first doctor in the town to even think of such. And he would give and explain, and give and tell them, and then deliver maybe 20 times a week, Maddie Ben and Benny May. That was only one point. Only one. All of his life he knew that there was a reason for his working. He always knew that he was meant to teach his people. All day he would go with his bag from house to house, and on all things he would talk to them.
After the long day, a heavy tiredness would come in him. But in the evening, when he opened the front gate, the tiredness would go away. There were Hamilton and Karl Marx and Portia and little William. There was Daisy, too. Portia took the lid from the pan on the stove and stirred the collards with the fork. "Father," she said after a while. Dr. Copeland cleared his throat and spat into a handkerchief. His voice was bitter and rough.
"Yes?"
"Let us quit this here quarreling with each other."
"We were not quarreling," said Dr. Copeland.
"It don't take words to make a quarrel," Portia said. "It looked to me like us is always arguing, even when we're sitting perfectly quiet like this. It's just this here feeling I have. I tell you the truth, every time I come to see you, it mighty near wears me out. So let us not try to quarrel anyway no more."
"It is certainly not my wish to quarrel. I am sorry if you have that feeling, daughter."
She poured out coffee and handed one cup, unsweetened, to her father. In her own portion, she put several spoons of sugar.
"I get hungry, and this will taste good to us. Drink your coffee while I tell you something which happened to us a piece back. Now that it's all over, it seems a little bit funny, but we got plenty of reason not to laugh too hard."
"Go ahead," said Dr. Copeland.
"Well, some time back, a real fine-looking, dressed-up colored man come in town here. He called himself Mr. B.F. Mason, and said he come from Washington, D.C., Every day he would walk up and down the street with a walking cane and a pretty colored shirt on. Then at night he'd go to the Society Cafe, eating finer than any man in this town. Every night he would order himself a bottle of gin and two pork chops for his supper. He always had a smile for everybody and was always bowing round to the girls and holding the door open for you to come in or go out. For about a week he made himself mighty pleasant wherever he were. People's begun to ask questions and wonder about this rich Mr. B.F. Mason. Then pretty soon, after he acquaints himself, he begun to settle down to business."
Portia spread out her lips and blew into her saucer of coffee.
"I suppose you done reading the paper about this government pincher business for old folks?"
Dr. Copeland nodded.
"Pension," he said.
"Well, he were connected with that. He were from the government. He had to come down from the president in Washington, D.C. to join everybody up for the government pinches. He went around from one door to the next, explaining how you pay $1 down to join, and after that 25 cents a week, and how when you were 45 years old, the government would pay you $50 every month of your life. All the peoples I know were very excited about this. He gave everybody that joined a free picture of the president with his name signed under it. He told how at the end of 6 months there was going to be free uniforms for every member. The club was called the Grand League of Pensioners for Colored Peoples. And at the end of 2 months, everybody was going to get an orange ribbon with a GLPCP on it to stand for the name. You know, like all these other letter things in the government. He come round from house to house with this little book, and everybody commenced to join. He wrote their names down and took the money. Every Saturday, he would collect. In 3 weeks, this Mr. B.F. Mason had joined up so many peoples, he couldn't get all the way around on Saturday. He had to pay somebody to take up the collections in each 3-4 blocks. I collected early every Saturday from near where we live and got that quarter. Of course, Willie had joined at the beginning for him and Highboy and me.
I have come across many pictures of the president in various houses near where you live, and I remember hearing the name Mason mentioned," said Dr. Copeland. "He was a thief?"
"He were," said Portia. "Somebody begun to find out about this Mr. B.F. Mason, and he were arrested. They found out he were from just plain Atlanta, and had never smelled no Washington, D.C., or no president. All the money were hid or spent. Willie had just throwed away $7.50.
Dr. Copeland was excited.
"That is what I mean by In the hereafter, Portia said, that man's sure gonna wake up with a hot pitchfork in his gut. But now that it's all over, it do seem a little bit funny, but of course, we got plenty reason not to laugh too hard. The Negro race, of its own accord, climbs up on the cross on every Friday, said Dr. Copeland. Portia's hand shook, and coffee trickled down from the saucer she was holding. She licked it from her arm. What you mean? I mean that I'm always looking. I mean that if I could just find 10 Negroes, 10 of my own people with spine and brains and courage who are willing to give all that they have, Portia put down the coffee.
Us was not talking about anything like that.
Only 4 Negroes, said Dr. Copeland. Only the sum of Hamilton and Karl Marx and William and you. Only 4 Negroes with these real true qualities and backbone.
Willie and Highboy and me have backbone, said Portia angrily. This here is a hard world, and it seemed to me us 3 struggles along pretty well.
For a minute they were silent. Dr. Copeland laid his spectacles on the table and pressed his shrunken fingers to his eyeballs.
You all the time using that word Negro, said Portia, and that word has a way of hurting people's feelings. Even old plain niggers better than that word. But polite peoples, no matter what shade they is, always says colored.
Dr. Copeland did not answer.
Take Willie and me. Us aren't all the way colored. Our mama was real light, and both of us have a good deal of white folks' blood in us. And Highboy, he Indian. He got a good part Indian in him. None of us is pure colored, and the word you all the time using has a way of hurting people's feelings.
I am not interested in subterfuges, said Dr. Copeland. I'm interested only in real truths.
Well, this here is our truth. Everybody is scared of you. It sure would take a whole lot of gin to get Hamilton or Buddy or Willie or my Highboy to come in this house and sit with you like I does. Willie say he remember you when he were only a little boy and he were afraid of his own father then.
Dr. Copeland coughed harshly and cleared his throat.
Everybody has feelings, no matter who they is. And nobody's gonna walk in no house where they certain their feelings will be hurt.
You the same way. I seen your feelings injured too many times by white peoples not to know that.
No, said Dr. Copeland. You have not seen my feelings injured.
Of course I realize that Willie or my Highboy or me, that none of us is scholars. But Highboy and Willie is both good as gold. There just is a difference between them and you.
Yes, said Dr. Copeland.
Hamilton or Buddy or Willie or me, none of us ever cares to talk like you. Us talk like our old mama and her peoples and their peoples before them. You think out everything in your brain, while us rather talk from something in our hearts that has been there for a long time. That's one of them differences.
Yes, said Dr. Copeland.
A person can't pick up their children and just squeeze them to which way they want them to be. Whether it hurt them or not, whether it right or wrong. You done tried that hard as any man could try, and now I'm the only one of us that would come in this here house and sit with you like this.
The light was very bright in Dr. Copeland's eyes, and her voice was loud and hard. He coughed, and his whole face trembled. He tried to pick up the cup of cold coffee, but his hand would not hold it steadily. The tears came to his eyes, and he reached for his glasses to try to hide them. Portia saw and went up to him quickly. She put her arms around his head and pressed her cheek to his forehead.
I done hurt my father's feelings, she said softly.
His voice was hard.
No, it is foolish and primitive to keep repeating this about hurt feelings.
The tears went slowly down his cheek, and the fire made them take on the colors of blue and green and red.
I'd be really and truly sorry, said Portia.
Dr. Copeland wiped his face with his cotton handkerchief.
It is all right. Let's us not ever quarrel no more. I can't stand this here fighting between us. It seemed to me that something real bad come up in us every time we be together. Let's us never quarrel like this no more.
No, said Dr. Copeland. Let us not quarrel.
Portia sniffled and wiped her nose with the back of her hand. For a few minutes she stood with her arms around her father's head. Then after a while she wiped her face for a final time and went over to the pot of greens on the stove.
It might have not time for these to be tender, she said cheerfully. Now I think I'll start making some of them good little hoe cakes to go along with them.
Portia moved slowly around the kitchen in her stocking feet, and her father followed her with his eyes. For a while again, they were silent. With his eyes wet, so that the edges of things were blurred, Portia was truly like her mother. Years ago, Daisy had walked like that around the kitchen, silent and occupied. Daisy was not black as he was. Her skin had been like the beautiful color of dark honey. She was always very quiet and gentle. But beneath that soft gentleness, there was something stubborn in her, and no matter how conscientiously he studied it all out, he could not understand the gentle stubbornness in his wife. He would exhort her, and he would tell her all that was in his heart, and still she was gentle. And still she would not listen to him, but would go on her own way. Then later, there were Hamilton and Karl Marx and William and Portia. And this feeling of real true purpose for them was so strong that he knew exactly how each thing should be with them. Hamilton would be a great scientist, and Karl Marx a teacher of the Negro race, and William a lawyer to fight against injustice, and Portia a doctor for women and children. And when they were even babies, he would tell them of the yoke they must thrust from their shoulders, the yoke of submission and slothfulness. And when they were a little older, he would impress upon them that there was no God, but that their lives were holy, and for each one of them there was this real true purpose. He would tell it to them over and over, and they would sit together, far away from him, and look with their big Negro children eyes at their mother, and Daisy would sit without listening, gentle and stubborn. Because of the true purpose for Hamilton, Karl Marx, William, and Portia, he knew how every detail should be. In the autumn of each year, he took them all into town and bought for them good black shoes and black stockings. For Portia, he bought black woolen material for dresses and white linen for collars and cuffs. For the boys, there was black wool for trousers and fine white linen for shirts. He did not want them to wear bright-colored, flimsy clothes, but when they went to school, those were the ones they wished to wear. And Daisy said that they were embarrassed and that he was a hard father. He knew how the house should be. There could be no fanciness, no gaudy calendars or lace pillows or knick-knacks, but everything in the house must be plain and dark and indicative of work and the real true purpose. Then one night, he found that Daisy had pierced holes in little Portia's ears for earrings. And another time, a Cupid doll with feather skirts was on the mantelpiece when he came home, and Daisy was gentle and hard and would not put it away. He knew, too, that Daisy was teaching the children the cult of meekness. She told them about hell and heaven. Also, she convinced them of ghosts and of haunted places. Daisy went to church every Sunday, and she talked sorrowfully to the preacher of her own husband. And with her stubbornness, she always took the children to the church, too, and they listened. The whole Negro race was sick, and he was busy all the day and sometimes half the night. After the long day, a great weariness would come in him, but when he opened the front gate of his home, the weariness would go away. Yet when he went into the house, William would be playing music on a comb wrapped in toilet paper, Hamilton and Karl Marx would be shooting craps for their lunch money, Portia would be laughing with her mother. He would start all over with them, but in a different way. He would bring out their lessons and talk with them. They would sit close together and look at their mother. He would talk and talk, but none of them wanted to understand. The feeling that would come on him was a black, terrible Negro feeling. He would try to sit in his office and read and meditate until he could be calm and start again.
He would pull down the shades of the room so that there would be only the bright light and the books and the feeling of meditation. But sometimes this calmness would not come. He was young, and the terrible feeling would not go away with study. Hamilton, Karl Marx, William, and Portia would be afraid of him and look at their mother, and sometimes when he realized this, the black feeling would conquer him, and he knew not what he did. He could not stop those terrible things, and afterward he could never understand.
"This here supper sure smells good to me," said Portia. "I expect us better eat now, because Highboy and Willie liable to come trooping in any minute."
Dr. Copeland settled his spectacles and pulled his chair up to the table. "Where have your husband and William been spending the evening?"
"They've been throwing horseshoes. This here Raymond Jones has a horseshoe place in his backyard. This Raymond and his sister, Love Jones, plays every night. Love is such an ugly girl, I don't mind about Highboy or Willie going round to their house any time they wishes. But they said they would come back for me at 9:45. I expected them now any minute."
"Before I forget," said Dr. Copeland, "I suppose you hear frequently from Hamilton and Karl Marx?"
"I does from Hamilton. He practically taken over all the work on our grandpapa's place. Buddy, he in Mobile, and you know he were never a big hand at writing letters. However, Buddy always have such a sweet way with people, so I don't ever worry concerning him. He the kind to always get along right well."
They sat silently at the table before the supper. Portia kept looking up at the clock on the cupboard because it was time for Highboy and Willie to come. Dr. Copeland bent his head over the plate. He held the fork in his hand as though it were heavy, and his fingers trembled. He only tasted the food, and with each mouthful he swallowed hard. There was a feeling of strain, and it seemed as though both of them wanted to keep up some conversation. Dr. Copeland did not know how to begin. Sometimes he thought that he had talked so much in the years before to his children, and they had understood so little, that now there was nothing at all to say. After a while, he wiped his mouth with his handkerchief and spoke in an uncertain voice.
"You have hardly mentioned yourself. Tell me about your job and what you have been doing lately."
"Course I still with the Kellys," said Portia. "But I tells you, Father, I don't know how long I'm going to be able to keep on with them. The work is hard, and it always take me a long time to get through. However, that don't bother me none. It about the pay I worries about. I supposed to get $3 a week, but sometimes Mrs. Kelly lacks a dollar or 50 cents of paying me the full amount. Of course, she always catches up on it soon as she able, but it has a way of leaving me in a pinch."
"Well, that's not right," said Dr. Copeland. "Why do you stand for it?"
"It ain't her fault. She can't help it," said Portia. "Half the folks in that house don't pay the rent, and it's a big expense to keep everything up. I tell you the truth, the Kellys is just barely keeping one jump ahead of the sheriff. They're having a mighty hard time."
"There ought to be some other job you can get."
"I know. But the Kellys is really grand white peoples to work for. I'm really fond of them as I can be. Them three little children is just like some of my own kinfolks. I feel like I done really raised Bubba and the baby. And although Mick and me is always getting into some kind of quarrel together, I have a real close fondness for her, too."
"But you must think of yourself," said Dr. Copeland.
"Mick, now," said Portia. "She a real case. Not a soul know how to manage that child. She just as bigoted and headstrong as she can be. Something going on in her all the time. I have a funny feeling about that child. It seemed to me that one of these days she gonna really surprise somebody. But whether that gonna be a good surprise or a bad surprise, I just don't know. Mick puzzled me sometimes. But still, I really fond of her."
"You must look out for your own livelihood first."
"As I say, it ain't Mrs. Kelly's fault. It costs so much to run that big old house, and the rent just don't be paid. Ain't but one person in that house who pay a decent amount for his room and pay on the dot without fail. And that man only been living there a short while. He one of these here deaf and dumb folks. He the first one of them I ever seen close up. But he a mighty fine white man."
"Tall, thin, with gray and green eyes?" asked Dr. Copeland suddenly. and always polite to everyone and very well dressed. Not like someone from this town, more like a northerner or maybe a Jew.
That him, said Portia.
Eagerness came into Dr. Copeland's face. He crumbled his hoe cake into the collard juice in his plate and began to eat with a new appetite.
I have a deaf-mute patient, he said.
How come you're acquainted with Mr. Singer? Asked Portia.
Dr. Copeland coughed and covered his mouth with his handkerchief. I have just seen him several times.
I better clean up now, said Portia. It's sure enough time for Willie, my high boy. But with this here real sink and grand running water, these little dishes won't take me 2 weeks.
The quiet insolence of the white race was one thing he had tried to keep out of his mind for years. When the resentment would come to him, he would cogitate and study. In the streets and around white people, he would keep the dignity on his face and always be silent. When he was younger, it was, boy, but now it was, uncle.
Uncle, run down to that filling station on the corner and send me a mechanic.
A white man in a car had called out those words to him not long ago.
Boy, give me a hand with this. Uncle, do that.
And he would not listen, but would walk on with the dignity in him and be silent. A few nights ago, a drunken white man had come up to him and begun pulling him along the street. He had his bag with him, and he was sure someone was hurt. But the drunkard had pulled him into a white man's restaurant, and the white men at the counter had begun hollering out with their insolence. He knew that the drunkard was making fun of him. Even then, he had kept the dignity in him. But with this tall, thin white man with the gray-green eyes, something had happened that had never happened to him with any white man before. It came about on a dark, rainy night several weeks ago. He had just come from a maternity case and was standing in the rain on a corner. He had tried to light a cigarette, and one by one the matches in his box fizzled out. He had been standing with the unlighted cigarette in his mouth when the white man stepped up and held for him a lighted match. In the dark, with the flame between them, they could see each other's faces. The white man smiled at him and lighted for him his cigarette. He did not know what to say, for nothing like that had ever happened to him before. They had stood for a few minutes on the street corner together, and then the white man had handed him his card. He wanted to talk to the white man and ask him some questions, but he did not know for sure if he could really understand. Because of the insolence of all the white race, he was afraid to lose his dignity in friendliness. But the white man had lighted his cigarette and smiled and seemed to want to be with him. Since then, he had thought this over many times.
I have a deaf-mute patient, said Dr. Copeland to Portia. The patient is a boy 5 years of age, and somehow I cannot get over the feeling that I am to blame for his handicap. I delivered him, and after 2 post-delivery visits, of course I forgot about him. He developed ear trouble, but the mother paid no attention to the discharges from his ears and did not bring him to me. When it was finally brought to my attention, it was too late. Of course, he hears nothing, and of course, he therefore cannot speak. But I have watched him carefully, and it seems to me that if he were normal, he would be a very intelligent child.
You always had a great interest in little children, said Portia. You care a heap more about them than about grown people's, don't you?
There is more hope in the young child, said Dr. Copeland. But this deaf boy, I have been meaning to make inquiries and find if there is some institution that would take him.
Mr. Singer would tell you. He a truly kind white man. He's not a bit biggity.
I do not know, said Dr. Copeland. I have thought once or twice about writing him a note and seeing if he could give me information.
Sure I would if I was you. You a grand letter writer. And I would give it to Mr. Singer for you, said Portia. He come down in the kitchen 2-3 weeks ago with a few shirts he wanted me to wrench out for him. Them shirts were no more dirty than if St. John the Baptist himself had been wearing them. All I had to do was dip them in warm water and give the collars a small rub and press them. But that night when I take them 5 clean shirts up to his room, you know how much he give me?
No.
He smile like he always do and hand over to me $1. A whole dollar just for them little shirts. He one really kind and pleasant white man, and I wouldn't be afraid to ask him any question. I wouldn't even mind writing that nice white man a letter myself. You go right ahead and do it, Father, if you wants to.
And perhaps I will, said Dr. Copeland.
Portia sat up suddenly and began arranging her tight, oily hair. There was the faint sound of a harmonica, and then gradually the music grew louder.
Here come Willie and Highboy, Portia said. I gotta go out now and meet them. You take care of yourself now, and send me a word if you needs me for anything. I did enjoy the supper with you and the talking very much.
The music from the harmonica was very clear now, and they could tell that Willie was playing while he waited at the front gate.
Wait a minute, said Dr. Copeland. I have only seen your husband with you about 2 times, and I believe we have never really met each other. And it has been 3 years since William has visited his father. Why not tell them to drop in for a little while?
Portia stood in the doorway, fingering her hair and her earrings.
Last time Willie come in here, you hurted his feelings. You see, you don't understand just how...
Very well, said Dr. Copeland. It was only a suggestion.
Wait, said Portia. I'm going to call them. I'm going to invite them in right now.
Dr. Copeland lighted a cigarette and walked up and down the room. He could not straighten his glasses to just the right position, and his fingers kept trembling. From the front yard, there was the sound of low voices. Then heavy footsteps were in the hall, and Portia, William, and Highboy entered the kitchen.
Here we is, said Portia. Highboy, I don't believe you and my father has ever truly been introduced to each other, but you knows who each other is.
Dr. Copeland shook hands with both of them. Willie hung back shyly against the wall, but Highboy stepped forward and bowed formally.
I has always heard so much about you, he said. I'd be very pleased to make your acquaintance.
Portia and Dr. Copeland brought in chairs from the hall, and the 4 of them sat around the stove. They were silent and uneasy. Willie gazed nervously around the room at the books on the kitchen table, the sink, the cot against the wall, and at his father. Highboy grinned and picked at his tie. Dr. Copeland seemed about to speak, and then he wet his lips and was still silent.
Willie, you were going pretty good with your harp, said Portia finally. Looked to me like you and Highboy must have got into somebody's gin bottle.
No, ma'am, said Highboy very politely. Us hadn't had anything since Saturday. Us have just been enjoying our horseshoe game.
Dr. Copeland still did not speak, and they all kept glancing at him and waiting. The room was close, and the quietness made everyone nervous.
I do have the hardest time with them boys' clothes, Portia said. I washes both of them white suits every Saturday, and I presses them twice a week. And look at them now. Of course, they don't wear them except when they gets home from work. But after 2 days, they seem to be putty black. I ironed them pants just last night, and now they're not a crease left.
Still, Dr. Copeland was silent. He kept his eyes on his son's face, but when Willie noticed this, he bit his rough, blunt fingers and stared at his feet. Dr. Copeland felt his pulse hammering at his wrists and temples. He coughed and held his fist to his chest. He wanted to speak to his son, but he could think of nothing to say. The old bitterness came up in him, and he did not have time to cogitate and push it down. His pulse hammered in him, and he was confused, but they all looked at him, and the silence was so strong that he had to speak. His voice was high, and it did not sound as though it came from himself.
William, I wonder how much of all the things I have said to you when you were a child have stayed in your mind.
I don't know what you means, Willie said.
The words came before Dr. Copeland knew what he would say.
I mean that to you and Hamilton and Karl Marx, I gave all that was in me, and I put all of my trust and hope in you, and all I get is blank misunderstanding and idleness and indifference. Of all I have put in, Nothing has remained. All has been taken away from me. All that I have tried to do.
Hush, said Portia. Father, you promised me that us would not quarrel. This here is crazy. Us can't afford to quarrel.
Portia got up and started toward the front door. Willie and Highboy followed quickly. Dr. Copeland was the last to come. They stood in the dark before the front door. Dr. Copeland tried to speak, but his voice seemed lost somewhere deep inside him. Willie and Portia and Highboy stood in a group together. With one arm, Portia held to her husband and brother, and with the other, she reached out to Dr. Copeland.
Let us all make up now before us goes. I can't stand this here fighting between us. Let us not ever quarrel no more.
In silence, Dr. Copeland shook hands again with each of them.
I am sorry, he said. It's quite all right with me, said Highboy politely.
It's quite all right with me, too,
Willie mumbled. Portia held all of their hands together.
Us just can't afford to quarrel.
They said goodbye, and Dr. Copeland watched them from the dark front porch as they went together up the street. Their footsteps, as they walked away, had a lonesome sound, and he felt weak and tired. When they were a block away, William began playing his harmonica again. The music was sad and empty. He stayed on the front porch until he could neither see nor hear them any longer. Dr. Copeland turned off the lights in his house and sat in the dark before the stove. But peace would not come to him. He wanted to remove Hamilton and Karl Marx and William from his mind. Each word that Portia had said to him came back in a loud, hard way to his memory. He got up suddenly and turned on the light. He settled himself at the table with his books by Spinoza and William Shakespeare and Karl Marx. When he read the Spinoza aloud to himself, the words had a rich, dark sound. He thought of the white man of whom they had spoken. It would be good if the white man could help him with Augustus, Benedict, Mattie, Lewis, the deaf patient. It would be good to write to the white man, even if he did not have this reason and these questions to ask. Dr. Copeland held his head in his hands, and from his throat there came the strange sound like a kind of singing moan. He remembered the white man's face when he smiled behind the yellow match flame on that rainy night. And peace was in him. 6. By midsummer, Singer had visitors more often than any other person in the house. From his room in the evening, there was nearly always the sound of a voice. After dinner at the New York Cafe, he bathed and dressed himself in one of his cool wash suits, and as a rule, he did not go out again. The room was cool and pleasant. He had an ice box in the closet where he kept bottles of cold beer and fruit drinks. He was never busy or in a hurry, and always he met his guests at the door with a welcome smile. Mick loved to go up to Mr. Singer's room. Even if he was a deaf and dumb mute, he understood every word she said to him. Talking with him was like a game, only there was a whole lot more to it than any game. It was like finding out new things about music. She would tell him some of her plans that she would not tell anybody else. He let her meddle with his cute little chessmen. Once, when she was excited and caught her shirt tail in the electric fan, he acted in such a kindly way that she was not embarrassed at all. Except for her dad, Mr. Singer was the nicest man she knew. When Dr. Copeland wrote the note to John Singer about Augustus Benedict Mattie Lewis, there was a polite reply and an invitation for him to make a call when he found the opportunity. Dr. Copeland went to the back of the house and sat with Portia a while in the kitchen. Then he climbed the stairs to the white man's room. There was truly none of the quiet insolence about this man. They had a lemonade together, and the mute wrote down the answer to the questions he wished to know. This man was different from any person of the white race whom Dr. Copeland had ever encountered. Afterward, he pondered about this white man a long time. Then later, inasmuch as he had been invited in a cordial manner to return, he made another visit.
Jake Blunt came every week. When he walked up to Singer's room, the whole stairway shook. Usually he carried a paper sack of beers. Often his voice would come out loud and angry from the room, but before he left, his voice gradually quieted. When he descended the stairs, he did not carry the sack of beers any longer, and he walked away thoughtfully without seeming to notice where he was going. Even Biff Branning came to the mute's room one night, but as he could never stay away from the restaurant for long, he left in a half hour. Singer was always the same to everyone. He sat in a straight chair by the window with his hands stuffed tight into his pockets and nodded or smiled to show his guests that he understood. If he did not have a visitor in the evening, Singer went to a late movie. He liked to sit back and watch the actors talking and walking about on the screen. He never looked at the title of a picture before going into a movie, and no matter what was showing, he watched each scene with equal interest. Then one day in July, Singer suddenly went away without warning. He left the door of his room open, and on the table, in an envelope addressed to Mrs. Kelly, there were $4 for the past week's rent. His few simple possessions were gone, and the room was very clean and bare. When his visitors came and saw this empty room, they went away with hurt surprise. No one could imagine why he had left like this. Singer spent all of his summer vacation in the town where Antonopoulos was being kept in the asylum. For months he had planned this trip and imagined about each moment they would have together. 2 weeks beforehand, his hotel reservation had been made, and for a long time he had carried his railroad ticket in an envelope in his pocket. Antonopoulos was not changed at all. When Singer came into his room, he ambled placidly to meet his friend. He was even fatter than before, but the dreamy smile on his face was just the same. Singer had some packages in his arms, and the big Greek gave them his first attention. His presents were a scarlet dressing gown, soft bedroom slippers, and 2 monogrammed nightshirts. Antonopoulos looked beneath all the tissue papers in the boxes very carefully. When he saw that nothing good to eat had been concealed there, he dumped the gifts disdainfully on his bed and did not bother with them any more. The room was large and sunny. Several beds were spaced in a row together. 3 old men played a game of slapjack in a corner. They did not notice Singer or Antonopoulos, and the 2 friends sat alone on the other side of the room. It seemed to Singer that years had passed since they had been together. There was so much to say that his hands could not shape the signs with speed enough. His green eyes burned and sweat glittered on his forehead. The old feeling of gaiety and bliss was so quick in him again that he could not control himself. Antonopoulos kept his dark, oily eyes on his friend and did not move. His hands fumbled languidly with the crotch of his trousers. Singer told him, among other things, about the visitors who had been coming to see him. He told his friend that they helped take his mind away from his lonesomeness. He told Antonopoulos that they were strange people and always talking, but that he liked to have them come. He drew quick sketches of Jake Blunt and Mick and Dr. Copeland. Then, as soon as he saw that Antonopoulos was not interested, Singer crumpled the sketches and forgot about them. When the attendant came in to say that their time was up, Singer had not finished half of the things he wanted to say, but he left the room very tired and happy. The patients could receive their friends only on Thursday and Sunday. On the days when he could not be with Antonopoulos, Singer walked up and down in his room at the hotel. His second visit to his friend was like the first, except that the old men in the room watched them listlessly and did not play slapjack. After much trouble, Singer obtained permission to take Antonopoulos out with him for a few hours. He planned each detail of the little excursion in advance. They drove out into the country in a taxi, and then at 4:30 they went to the dining room at the hotel. Antonopoulos greatly enjoyed his extra meal. He ordered half the dishes on the menu and ate very greedily. But when he had finished, he would not leave. He held to the table. Singer coaxed him, and the cab driver wanted to use force.
Antonopoulos sat stolidly and made obscene gestures when they came too close to him. At last, Singer bought a bottle of whiskey from the hotel manager and lured him into the taxi again. When Singer threw the unopened bottle out of the window, Antonopoulos wept with disappointment and offense. The end of their little excursion made Singer very sad. His next visit was the last one, for his 2 weeks vacation was almost over. Antonopoulos had forgotten what had happened before. They sat in their same corner of the room. The minutes slipped by quickly. Singer's hands talked desperately, and his narrow face was very pale. At last it was time for him to go. He held his friend by the arm and looked into his face in the way that he used to do when they parted each day before work. Antonopoulos stared at him drowsily and did not move. Singer left the room with his hands stuffed hard into his pockets. Soon after Singer returned to his room at the boarding house, Mick and Jake Blunt and Dr. Copeland began to come again. Each one of them wanted to know where he had been and why he had not let them know about his plans, but Singer pretended that he did not understand their questions, and his smile was inscrutable. One by one they would come to Singer's room to spend the evening with him. The mute was always thoughtful and composed. His many-tinted, gentle eyes were grave as a sorcerer's. Mick Kelly and Jake Blunt and Dr. Copeland would come and talk in the silent room, for they felt that the mute would always understand whatever they wanted to say to him. And maybe even more than that.